Good day. Today is Friday, 29th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me again remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, over the last couple of programmes, I have been discussing the situation with potential Russian strikes against Kiev and the various warnings that the Russians have been giving about those and the strong advice the Russians have given to the United States and indirectly to other Western governments to withdraw their embassies and their diplomatic and other personnel from the Ukrainian capital. So far, as I've discussed in my most recent program, Western governments have kept their embassies in Kiev. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, has made a, as is often the case with him, rather sour comment about this. He said that Western governments seem to have diplomats aplenty and are not so bothered, therefore, if they lose some. Well, I'm not going to comment further about that. But anyway, Western governments for the moment have kept their embassies in Kiev and continue to insist that they won't withdraw their staff from Kiev. One person who might be heeding the Russian warnings, however, is the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky. As he now regularly does, he has left Kiev at the first opportunity, and there's been some sour comments across the media, independent media, that this is fairly typical of Zelensky. He tends to stay away from Kiev when there are signs of trouble. Anyway, I'm not exactly certain of his movements, but it does seem that he went to Sweden and spent some time there and had meetings with the Swedish government. There's now again talk about Sweden supplying, some say, up to 17 Gripen fighter jets to Ukraine, which supposedly will reach Ukraine at the start of next year. This, by the way, looks like a completely impossible timetable for me. If we take our minds back a little way, it took a very long time before F-16s and Mirage 2000s appeared in Ukraine. When they did, it was clear that the pilots who were trained to fly them were not really adept at doing this. And in fact, those F-16s and Mirage 2000s haven't changed the situation on the battlefields in any way at all. Now, the Gripen is a more modern fighter. It's definitely a fourth generation fighter and apparently one of the most advanced amongst modern fourth generation fighter jets. Whether it does actually bring any significant additional capability is something I'm going to leave to people who know a lot more about this sort of thing than I do. But unless there's been a training program for Ukrainian pilots that has been underway for a very long time, longer than has been reported, I would have thought that the timescale to bring Gripens into Ukraine in just 1 year is improbable. And even if we assume that Ukrainian pilots have been training on Gripens for, say, 2 or 3 years, it still seems to me a very short time frame to induct a fighter like this into the Ukrainian defense systems. But anyway, let's not waste time about this. Zelensky was in Stockholm. I'm not sure where he is at the present time, except that I don't believe he is in Kiev. Now, in the meantime, we have had significant drone strikes by the Russians against Ukraine and attempted drone strikes by the Ukrainians against the Russians, but nothing which, to my mind, looks especially out of the ordinary. I said a few days ago that assuming that the Russians are indeed on the brink of launching a sustained missile offensive against Kiev, they would probably wait several days before they did so. Firstly, to give the embassies an opportunity to leave, but also because my sense is that the Russians are never in a rush to start these things, and they will be probably working on and planning their next move. Now, along the way, I've had a very interesting email from someone who, shall we say, has information about these sort of things, who provides this information directly from Russia. Further information from this person about the nature of the Oreshnik system. And this person has been in correspondence with me for some time. And as I said, his information has been consistently reliable. And he's pointed out to me that the TASS dispatch that I discussed in my program yesterday, in which I discussed certain comments about the Oreshnik system made by a Russian specialist, a man called Stepanov, which confirmed that the Oreshnik is indeed designed to destroy underground facilities. Anyway, this person pointed out to me that everything that Stepanov said, this person had already pointed out to me in private emails. And this is absolutely correct. I should treat, and in fact, I do treat, Stepanov's comments as corroboration of what this source has been saying. Anyway, in the process, this source provided me with further information about the Oreshnik, which I treat as reliable. Firstly, he said that the single event that triggered the Russian decision to start development of the Oreshnik was the battle for the Azovstal factory in Mariupol. The Russians realized that they did not have weapons that were properly designed to penetrate and attack these underground structures, apart perhaps from the massive 9-ton bomb that is carried by Russian strategic bombers, but which has never been deployed in Ukraine up to now. And of course, since that is a gravity bomb, it could only be deployed if those bombers were prepared to operate above targets that might have air defenses. So the Russians apparently then began a program to develop a system which could attack these underground structures from long range. And that system became the Oreshnik. And the Oreshnik does indeed come in a variety of families. So there is the classic Oreshnik that we saw used in November 2024 in Dnipro in January 2026, close to Lvov, and which we saw also being used against the target in this satellite town south of Kiev. And this is the Oreshnik with the six metal kinetic, with the six kinetic launch vehicles, which drops large numbers of kinetic warheads, steel kinetic warheads, on a target. And that is essentially an area weapon. But as this source reminded me, the kinetic shock of all of these impacts does indeed cause significant ground tremors, and that does actually cause very considerable damage to structures located below the ground of where these strikes take place. So that is the classic Oreshnik. There is another variant which has three bigger warheads. And as from what I understand, these are much larger warheads. And these are indeed designed for deeper penetration. The way in which this particular Oreshnik functions is different. And it may be, and I don't want to speculate too far, I'm going beyond what this source said, it may be that these massive warheads are slowed as they approach the ground, enabling still greater penetration. But this type of the Oreshnik can and does indeed have significant ground penetration capabilities. This source said greater than any other weapon system in service up to now, greater than the bombs, the bunker busting bombs that the United States used against Fordow in Iran in June of last year. Now, that of course reminds me of the attack on the facility in Dnipro, which took place about 2 weeks ago. Again, there was much speculation that some type of new weapon was used against that facility. There were flashes that pointed to three warheads being used. Maybe it was this weapon system that was used against the facility in Dnipro, in which case, perhaps the target was indeed some underground bunker complex located in the Yuzhmash factory, about which we have been told very little. There is a third variant of the Oreshnik, which has a massive single unitary warhead, and that can do enormous damage, and that's presumably even intended to do even greater focused damage on a particular target. Then there is yet another variant which uses some kind of very advanced thermobaric warhead. So that would be another area type of weapon. And lastly, there is a further variant about which my source was not well informed, but which he thinks may be nuclear capable. Anyway, that gives us a sense of the family of weapons that the Oreshnik might amount to. And here, I'm going to say something further. If it is indeed the case that the Russians began development of the Oreshnik after the siege of the Azovstal factory in 2022, then the development time for this system has been extraordinarily fast and unprecedentedly fast in terms of weapons of this kind. Certainly in the West, the Chinese probably could replicate these sort of development speeds. And it would also explain why the Oreshnik uses wherever he can various legacy technologies left over from the RSD-10 Pioneer system, the SS-20, that was developed by the Soviets in the 1970s, just to say. Anyway, I pass on all of this. I'm confident of the reliability of this source. Others can take this information and decide upon it and comment upon it as they wish. Let me repeat that my source obtains this information from inside Russia. And that's all I'm going to say about him. Anyway, that's as I said, what we might be looking at in the future. It hasn't happened yet, but no doubt at some point, relatively soon, we will be seeing it. Now, that's about future attacks on Kiev. There have, in fact, also been significant developments on the front lines. And I want to touch on those because, with all the focus on missiles and drones, and with all the endless articles that we see about the effectiveness of drones on the front lines, I notice that there is minimal discussion now across the Western media about the actual movements which are indeed taking place on the front lines. Now, let's start with the most important battle of all, which is being fought at the moment, which is the Battle of Konstantinovka. To repeat again, Konstantinovka is the southernmost in a line of towns that make up a fortified line of towns in western Donbass, to be precise, in western Donetsk region. It's often referred to as a line of fortress towns, including by the Institute of the Study of for the Study of War in Washington. There is Slavyansk at the north, there is Kramatorsk just to the south, there is Druzhivka, which is, in my opinion, basically a suburb of Kramatorsk, and then some distance further south, but nonetheless part of the same overall conurbation, there is Konstantinovka. Now, the battle for Konstantinovka began in earnest soon after the fall of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd in December. And over the last 2 days, it has seemed as if events in Konstantinovka were gaining further speed. And in fact, various of the mapping projects are now starting to color more and more of Konstantinovka red. It seems as if Ukrainian resistance in southern Konstantinovka has essentially collapsed. One of the two areas in southern Konstantinovka, which many had speculated had become a cauldron for the Ukrainian troops, where the Ukrainian troops had become surrounded by the Russians, that area has now been colored by the mapping projects red, meaning that it has passed essentially and securely under Russian control. The Ukrainians have been conducting drone strikes on industrial targets in the northern areas of central Konstantinovka, which show that these industrial structures, that the drone attacks, that the drones have been, the Ukrainian drones have been attacking, are indeed under Russian control. There is another cauldron, or at least the mapping projects show another cauldron, another area where the Ukrainian forces are surrounded, somewhat to the east of the cauldron that has now collapsed. But everyone who has been following this battle closely and who takes what you might call an objective view of what is taking place there assumes that this cauldron is about to collapse as well. Now, when that happens, all of southern and central Konstantinivka will be under Russian control. The Russians will control between 50 and 60% of the town. And not only that, but it will be the most heavily built up part of the town. The part with the high-rise buildings and the factories and the railway stations and the other locations which the Ukrainians have used as fortresses. And shortly before I did this program, there were further reports which point to a collapsing situation for the Ukrainians in Konstantinivka. Now, these reports come from various sources, mostly Ukrainian, and they all say the same thing, that there has been a sudden disappearance of Ukrainian drones operating in the skies above Konstantinivka. And the assumption is that either the Russians have managed to catch up and kill or disable the Ukrainian drone operators in Konstantinivka, or more plausibly, given that drone operators are now essential for the Ukrainians in war, in this war, and the Ukrainians cannot afford to lose them, the Ukrainians, sensing the collapse of resistance in Konstantinivka, have pulled them all out. Now, if this is correct, and as I said, there's multiple reports which all say the same thing, then we are indeed looking at the final days of Konstantinivka. There is something further that suggests this also. East of Konstantinivka, there is an area of broken country with various villages and ravines and hills, which lies between Konstantinivka and the town of Chasiv Yar, which the Russians captured about a year ago. And apparently, there have been significant numbers of Ukrainian troops in this area. And from time to time, the Ukrainian troops in this area have conducted strikes against the Russians in Chasiv Yar. They've attempted to keep the battle of Chasiv Yar going in some form, even though the city itself, the town of Chasiv Yar, is indeed actually under Russian control. Well, there are reports that the Russians have now created a ring around these troops, that they are, in other words, in a cauldron, and that the Russians are leafleting these troops, these Ukrainian troops, telling them to surrender. So if you put it all together, a very, very significant crisis playing out in Konstantinivka and in its environs indeed. And to repeat again, if, or rather when Konstantinivka falls, that will bring the Russians immediately south of Druzhivka and the Slavyansk, the remainder of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation, bringing this territory, this remaining group of towns under much closer siege. And alongside all of that, there are now some reports that the Battle of Raya Alexandrovka, a village located to the east of Kramatorsk, which is located on some kind of hill or elevation, and which looks down upon the supply roads into Kramatorsk. Well, there are reports that Raya Alexandrovka also is about to fall. The noose around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and the Ukrainian defenders is now rapidly tightening. And given that Donbass has been the area of the most intense battles in this war by far, it is extraordinary. It is very indicative that the Western media and the Ukrainians themselves are saying so little about this situation. Now, there's also been more information from what you might call the Western advance, the furthest Western advance of the Russians in the Zaporozhye, Dnipropetrovsk regions. Another important settlement in Dnipropetrovsk has apparently just been captured by the Russians, opening potentially the way for an advance to an important town called Mezhuva, which is used by the Ukrainians as a logistics hub. But, of course, the main news continues to be around Orekhov, and the Russians have been continuing their advance westwards towards Orekhov now that they've broken through the Ukrainian defences in places like Vyzhivka, Verkhnaya Terska, and before long, Guliapolsk as well. And we've had a significant amount of drone footage now of Orekhov itself. There appears to be very heavy bombing of Orekhov taking place. The Russian Air Force has been very active, dropping FAB bombs in the town, particularly its northern areas. There's some suggestions, or this is all drawn from the leak of what's supposed to be the Russian General Staff map of 9th April of this year, that the Russians actually already control southern Orekhov. And as I pointed out in previous programs, Gerasimov, the overall Russian military commander, actually claimed this about 2 months ago. But anyway, it's clear that northern Orekhov, at least, is still under Ukrainian control, but is being heavily bombed. And besides, the Russian army is now moving further and faster towards it. No doubt, all sorts of other things are taking place elsewhere on the front lines. About a week ago, Gerasimov also said that the Russians control 85% of Liman. Again, we've no corroboration of this, but of course, if it's true, it's important. And it means that the position north of Slavyansk is deteriorating. And there's been ample evidence of the Russians expanding the territory they control in Kharkiv and Sumy region. And there's just been reports that the Russians have captured more small villages closer to the town of Beli Kolodis, which many expect to be a proximate Russian objective in Kharkiv region, with the consensus that if Beli Kolodis is indeed captured by the Russians, then a very large territory in northeastern Kharkiv region will almost automatically pass under Russian control. I am not fully up to date with the situation in these places, but for the moment, my focus is on Donbass and on Zaporozhye region. And in both of these places, we can see that advances are indeed taking place. And yes, they might be described as incremental, but they are advances nonetheless, and they are nothing like as slow or as insignificant as the Ukrainians and the Western media and some Western governments would have you believe. Now, alongside all of this, the Ukrainians continue to release lots of drone footage of their drones attacking vehicles along the road, the big highway, which goes from Mariupol to Crimea, and beyond Crimea, by the way, into Kherson region. And there's been an enormous amount of discussion about these drone attacks. There's a number of points I would make about this story. Firstly, the drones that the Ukrainians are using to conduct these attacks are not FPV drones, first-person view drones. They're bigger drones of the type that the Ukrainians use to attack targets inside Russia. It seems that the Ukrainians have reassigned some of their drones, some of their drone operators who have been involved in attacks against Russia, to some kind of campaign against traffic along this road. Secondly, the fact that we are not talking about FPV drones confirms that the Ukrainians are in fact a long distance from this road. The maps all show that too, but clearly there is no direct threat from the Ukrainians to this road. Thirdly, the Russians will fairly quickly get on top of the situation. They will establish netting over the road. They were the first, by the way, to start placing netting along the road. They have various air defense systems that they've now developed, and which, by the way, are being made available to private businesses in Russia, enabling institutions like banks, factories, oil refineries like the ones in Tuapse to develop their own anti-drone defences. And this is interesting, by the way, and very suggestive. And it does beg some questions about what this technology and what these systems is. But it looks as if over the next few days, targets across Russia are going to significantly harden, and it's going to be much more difficult for the Ukrainians to conduct successful drone strikes against targets across Russia in the way that they did until recently. But no doubt, whatever this technology is, the Russians are going to provide it to defend the road. But to repeat again, the single most important point about the attack on this road is that though obviously it will have some effect on Russian logistics, by far the bulk of Russian supplies for the military do not travel by road. They travel by rail. And the Russians have built a network of railways in this very same area since the start of the special military operation, and I have seen pictures of supply trains, Russian supply trains, using precisely these railway lines. And, well, given that this is so, if you're talking about the logistics of the Russian military, this drone offensive, Ukrainian drone offensive against this road, will only have a certain amount of effect. And, well, as I've said many times, because of my vision issues, I'm not the best person, perhaps, to understand drone footage, of which the Ukrainians have been publishing a suspiciously large amount of this, of these attacks on this road. But to the best that I can see, most of the vehicles on the road which the Ukrainians have attacked and in many cases destroyed are civilian commercial vehicles. In other words, trucks and passenger cars, but especially trucks, supplying civilian goods to Crimea. Now, that, of course, is something that the Russians will want to stop, but it's unlikely to have a big impact on the war itself. To my mind, and this is obviously a preliminary view, this offensive on the road has something of a performative, theatrical quality about it. It gives the impression that the Ukrainians are able to do something to disrupt Russian military logistics, rather than that they are actually doing something which does seriously disrupt those logistics. The Russians, by contrast, their drones continue to be very active behind the front lines, and here we can see that they do attack trucks, military trucks, providing supplies to the Ukrainian military, and that the Russians have perfected that strategy, which they, of course, embarked on way back in the spring of 2024. So, anyway, that is the situation on the front lines. I've been saying it for a while, but I'm going to say it again. At some point fairly soon, things in the war are going to start becoming so changed and difficult for Ukraine that, as happens every year, the narrative of a stalemate, of an impasse, of the Russians being forced onto a standstill, that narrative is again going to become unsustainable. To the extent that people in the West, particularly governments in the West, believe this narrative, when it starts to break down, especially now when we are at the end point of the Donbass battle and with the Russians closing on the city of Zaporozhye and on the Dnieper, well, when, as I said, the penny finally drops, that in fact there is no stalemate and there is no standstill, and that the Russians are indeed breaking through, then I suspect that some kind of panic and hysteria across the West is indeed going to take place, and we will probably at that point see renewed demands for some kind of direct Western intervention in the war, to save Ukraine. But that brings me directly to the next point of this program, because over the last 5 months, 6 months in fact, we've had this extraordinary discussion and debate in Europe about whether in this situation it makes any sense to talk to the Russians at all, and whether negotiations between the Europeans and the Russians should begin. Now, when Donald Trump, soon after his inauguration last year, began to reach out to the Russians, and the Russians and the Americans first started or resumed contacts with each other, the response in Europe was one of horror, followed by demands that Europe be consulted and be invited to participate directly in the negotiations which were taking place between the Russians and the Americans. The Americans and the Russians rebuffed these European demands. In fact, the situation at times became almost farcical. So there was a moment, I remember in March last year, when the Americans wanted to talk to the Ukrainians in order to get the Ukrainians to agree to a ceasefire, something which up to then the Ukrainians had resisted. And realizing that the Ukrainians were being told by their European friends to hold out at that time against the ceasefire, and in addition, in order to ensure that Zelensky himself didn't muddy the waters with the discussions, the Americans arranged to meet with the Ukrainians in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, making sure that Zelensky couldn't come and that the Europeans were kept far away and at arm's length. I discussed this all at the time in videos that I did. And then, since then, with the Europeans, finally, and by the way, initially very gradually, having come round to accepting the idea of a ceasefire, and having, as the situation for Ukraine on the battlefronts deteriorates, having then run with the idea of a ceasefire, the Europeans changed their stance further and demanded that they be included in the talks between the Americans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians, and things descended to totally farcical levels in February, when the Americans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians all met with each other in Geneva, and the national security advisors of various European governments then decided that they would all turn up at the same hotel where these talks between the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the Americans were taking place, and would try to gate crash the talks. And you had a ludicrous situation where you saw national security advisors, very high level officials from Britain, France, Germany, milling around in Geneva, in the hotel lobby, meeting with the Ukrainians, meeting with the Americans. The Russians, as I remember, wanted to have nothing to do with them, but with the Europeans urgently insisting that they must actually be part of the talks. The Russians and the Americans told the Europeans to keep away. Well, that was in February. Now, by that point, the Europeans, in theory, had already decided that the moment had come for them to speak to the Russians. And as I said, there's been discussions about that ever since. As I said, they tried to gate crash the talks between the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the Americans in February. They've sort of agreed on the need to appoint a chief negotiator, but they've never agreed on who that should be, and they've never agreed on what message that chief negotiator should convey to the Russians. And, well, despite the Europeans grumbling and complaining that they've been frozen out of the talks, when we've reached that point where they agree that they should be part of the talks, or said they've agreed that they should be part of the talks, and where they agreed that that means that they should reach out directly and talk to the Russians and not rely on the Americans. Well, when that's happened, the Europeans are just not able to organise themselves and are not able to move forward with that decision. And it's become obvious that there are some European leaders who are actively sabotaging that decision. One of them, of course, is the EU's foreign affairs minister, if you like to call her that, Kaya Kallas. There was a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Cyprus. She said the talking to Russia was a trap. Actual words were, "I find that it is a trap that Russia wants us to walk into, that we discuss who talks to them, and they are already picking who is suitable and who is not." And when you go on and read further what she has to say, I mean, you get the sense that what Kaya Kallas really means by words like that is that talking to the Russians at all is some kind of a trap. And then she's been talking about the further demands that she insists the Russians must agree to if there are going to be discussions between them and the Europeans. And if those discussions do eventually lead to some kind of negotiated resolution of the war. And amongst the things that Kaya Kallas is demanding is that Russia, not apparently Ukraine, should agree restrictions on the size of its armed forces. Now, Kallas is demanding these things of a nuclear power, a great power, a country that's very active in diplomacy, global diplomacy around the world, which has extremely powerful armed forces, and which, as I've carefully pointed out now, is in fact advancing and winning in Ukraine, and is now closing in on a decisive victory in Donbass. Yet, in Kaya Kallas' mind, negotiations must be about the Russians capitulating. Any other sort of negotiations with the Russians are merely a trap. Now, this is beyond bizarre, and this group of European leaders, Kaya Kallas obviously, is only one apparently are numerous enough and are strong enough so that they've so far been able to block any move towards conducting negotiations and have instead kept European attention focused on continued military build-ups against Russia. And well, there's been, I think, a brilliantly insightful article by the commentator Gordon Hahn about this, one of the most insightful commentators altogether about the war. And well, Gordon Hahn, you can find this whole article on his Substack site, by the way. Anyway, the point that Gordon Hahn is making is that though it is probably true that the majority of leaders in Europe generally do not want war with Russia, they understand the devastating effect of such a war, that there is a small but very powerful group of leaders, Kaja Kallas obviously being one, who give every impression ultimately of wanting that very thing, a war between Europe and Russia. And what they are trying to do, obviously, is to avoid negotiations, which might find a route forward, perhaps not to settle the conflict in Ukraine itself, but some kind of route forward to some kind of understanding between the Europeans and the Russians until this great military build-up in Europe is completed, when, as these leaders suppose, the chance will come for the Europeans to enter directly the war with Russia, maybe in Ukraine, and to defeat them there. Now, I have to say that this all seems to me so irrational that in any other situation, it would make no sense. As I've pointed out in several programs, the military build-up that the Europeans are talking about, in actual military terms, in fact, isn't happening. The Europeans have talked a lot about rearmament. They spent a lot of money on rearmament, but they haven't so far actually achieved any rearmament. In fact, some of the initiatives are already beginning to fall away. I have discussed at great length in earlier programs President Pavel's fantastic idea of buying artillery shells on the international arms market. We haven't heard very much about this project recently. Well, it turns out that it is still in place. I'm not sure how many artillery shells it has actually provided to Ukraine, and I'm not going to even try to get the cost. It seems that some European states, EU states, have recently become completely fed up with this project and have pulled out of it en masse, though there is still a rump of states that cling to it and continue to throw good money after bad in support of it. Anyway, that's just a further example of the way in which, despite all the claims about weapons build-ups and arms build-ups in Europe, the reality is in the opposite direction. it is the Russians building up their armies and the Europeans continuing to scale down theirs. It is the Russians building and equipping themselves with more and more weapons, and the Europeans reducing still further their weapons inventories as they continue to send what they still have in ever greater numbers to Ukraine. And Gordon Hunt makes the completely valid point in the same article that the 3-year timeline that the Europeans appear to be thinking of, and which Zelensky appears to be thinking of too, might also point to the Europeans looking forward to the election in 2028 of a Democrat president who will recommit to Project Ukraine. But if so, it again seems to me that the Europeans are ignoring the obvious, which is that following the events in the Middle East, there simply won't be enough weapons in the United States, even by 2028, to take on the Russians. And any new president who is inaugurated in January 2029 simply will not have that option. But anyway, that is the only way that this very strange situation of the situation in Ukraine deteriorating day by day, but the Europeans, who now have essential ownership of the war, the Americans having, to a great extent, though not entirely, moved away Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, spoke about that. Anyway, we have this very strange situation in which the Europeans are in vehement denial of what is actually happening on the front lines, that Ukraine's position continues to get worse, are in vehement denial of their own inability to re-equip with themselves with weapons to take on the Russians. But still, despite all of that, refuse to talk to the Russians and reject any opportunity which might be offered to do so. Well, all I would say is that in the meantime, and this is also something that's touched on in Gordon Hahn's article, the European War Party continues to do everything it can to go on increasing tensions with Russia. Shortly before I started making this program, there was an enormous amount of criticism and commentary and fear statements from European leaders about the fact that what is claimed to be a Russian drone supposedly entered Romanian airspace and did some damage in Romania. I'm choosing my words extremely carefully. For all I know, it was a Russian drone, and for all I know, it did overfly Ukrainian territory, and it did impact on a target, or rather on it did fall in Romania itself. I am sure that the Russians were not intentionally targeting Romania. Why would they want to do so with a single drone? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. But I am prepared to believe that such a thing might have happened. But anyway, all over Europe, we hear shrill calls of voices condemning the Russians for being reckless. This was said by the NATO Secretariat, with fervid statements about how NATO is going to defend from the Russians every inch of this of its territory. This said by a NATO which is deeply implicated in the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia. On that, the deputy chair of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, has himself also had some things to say. He's just posted the following comment: European countries are direct participants in the war against Russia, and no one disputes this anymore. Indeed, they are using the Ukrainians as proxies, but what difference does it make for us? European drones, their components and other weapons, to say nothing of intelligence, a part of everyday attacks on our country. What they do leads to damage to homes and civilian casualties. The responsibility for all this, including the attack on Starobelsk, lies with, and then he uses a very uncomplimentary word, with people, shall we say, like Ursula von der Leyen, Merz, Macron, Starmer, and other. And then he uses a further very uncomplimentary word to describe these people, the kind of language which I'm not going to use because, well, to be said straightforwardly, I dislike using it. And of course, what Medvedev says is perfectly true, and everybody knows this, and it's been going on all the time, and yet here we have the whole of Europe in uproar over a single, possibly Russian drone. And then there's all the drones that have been flying over Scandinavia and the Baltic states. Now, the claim that is circulating now, certainly in the British media, is that these Ukrainian drones have in some way been electronically captured, or hijacked, as some people put it, by the Russians, and that the Russians have cunningly redirected the drones, these Ukrainian drones, to conduct strikes or to hit targets within the Baltic states and perhaps Finland. And that therefore the entire blame for this whole situation lies entirely with the Russians, and that what is happening is a further manifestation of Russian aggressiveness. Now, a couple of days ago, in a video, I touched on this theory. I said that I had no information that would refute it. It did not seem completely impossible to me. I could imagine that the Russians might do something like this. But now we have none other than the president of Finland, Alexander Stubb, and he's come out and said that he has seen no evidence at all that these Ukrainian drones are indeed being controlled or guided by the Russians. That, in fact, everything about these drone incursions into the Baltic states and Scandinavia points to their being due to sloppy management of the drones by the Ukrainians themselves. Well, maybe Stubb is wrong, but it does seem to me that as the president of Finland, he's probably in the best position to know. And it looks as if that whole narrative construct about Ukrainian drones being controlled by the Russians has just collapsed. But of course, it's not just drones that have been conducting strikes inside Russia. Drones largely manufactured in Europe, provided with guidance information by the Americans and by the Europeans, exactly as Medvedev says. But other things which have been happening as well. Yesterday, in my program, I touched on the fact that some of the tankers ferrying oil from Russia, which have been attacked on the high seas, about which there's been speculation that they were attacked by Ukrainian drones on the high seas. Well, it turns out that some of these tankers, or in fact other merchant ships, weren't attacked in that way at all. They'd had explosive devices either attached to their hulls in the form of magnetic mines, or they've had explosives smuggled on board into them. Now, I say this, and again, there has to be a qualifier, because the information about this has come completely from the Russians, and it could be, again, that the Russians are making all this up, though I have seen no evidence at all that they are. But anyway, let's assume that this is true. It seems that at least some of these ships have at times docked in Western ports, and it looks at least possible that it was whilst they were in these ports that the magnetic mines, and well, let's call them bombs, were either affixed to the hulls of these ships or smuggled inside them. Now, how is that possible without at least someone in the security services across Europe turning a blind eye? A few days ago, about a week ago, Ukrainian sea drones were washing up on beaches in Greece. How did they get there? Why? How were they operating in such a place, given the distance between Greece and Ukraine? And given that these drones, if they were to come from Ukraine, would have to cross into the Aegean through the Turkish-controlled Dardanelles, is it far more likely that they were being operated in the Eastern Mediterranean itself, and that they had been positioned there, again, with the knowledge and assistance of some European governments? This kind of thing is taking place all the time. And again, as Medvedev says, it's obviously happening with direct involvement from the Europeans, at the very least. And it's become, in effect, an everyday thing. Now, none of this is making any actual difference to the war. Russian oil exports, as I pointed out in many programs, have been completely unaffected. The overall situation in the Russian economy has been completely unaffected. The military situation on the battlefields in Ukraine has been unaffected as well. But from a Russian point of view, all of these actions by the Europeans, well, To say that it is hostile would be a huge understatement. It's obviously much worse than that. It makes the Europeans, as Medvedev says, co-belligerents. And of course, some of this activity takes place in the open. A couple of days ago, a British surveillance aircraft was buzzed over the Black Sea. Well, actually, it wasn't a few weeks ago. It was about a few weeks ago, I believe it was in April, though the British government only acknowledged that this had happened a couple of days ago. But anyway, a surveillance aircraft from Britain was buzzed by Russian fighter jets over the Black Sea. The British protested about that. But what exactly is a British reconnaissance aircraft doing there at all, so far from British territory, given that the Black Sea is a war zone? Doesn't that also point to Britain being a co-belligerent in some way, given Britain's intense support for Ukraine? On that topic, Britain and Poland have just signed a treaty with each other, a military treaty, which is bizarre when you think about it, when given that Poland and Britain are already military allies, because both of them are members of NATO. But the treaty, this military alliance, which the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk quite straightforwardly says is directed at Russia. Well, when you read it through carefully, it speaks about military assistance being provided by Poland and Britain to each other. It suggests that in both Warsaw and London, there are now genuine debates about the US, the long-term US commitment to NATO. But when you read the draft carefully, even more when you listen to Donald Tusk's words, it seems fairly clear, at least to me, that the objective is to bring Poland and Britain into a reciprocal alliance in which Poland provides the conventional forces, the soldiers and the armies, and Britain provides the nuclear weapons. Well, that's how it looked to me. And if it looked like that to me, I am confident that that is how it also looks to the Russians. Just saying. So all of this pointless, dangerous belligerence and, well, all of this already at a time when the situation in Ukraine is deteriorating, but which has not yet reached that critical point, which I expect it to reach fairly soon. Well, what happens then? What do the Europeans think and do when the Russian strikes against Kiev intensify, when the siege of the remaining Donbass towns becomes impossible to ignore anymore? when large cauldrons of Ukrainian troops are created, and when it does finally look as if the Russians are on the brink of reaching Zaporozhye, and the Dnieper in its central places. Given the belligerence we are already seeing, I think things are going to go off the scale. We must prepare ourselves for an extremely fraught and very tense summer and autumn. At the very least, I expect that demands for no-fly zones and for deployment of European forces to Ukraine are going to resume again with very great added force. I personally would not be surprised if some deployments of European troops to Western Ukraine specifically do actually take place. And with the Russians now having this armory of Oreshniks at their disposal, well, one can easily imagine what might happen. Anyway, there it is. We are on the brink of a very, very dangerous period between Russia and Europe, at the very least now. Both the Russians and the Europeans are escalating and hardening their position. The Ukrainians are caught in the middle, and there's, in some respects, especially while Zelensky remains in charge, little that they can directly do. But, well, as I said, the next few months, I think, are going to be very tense. Well, now let me turn to other topics. We still have this tiresome story about whether the memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran is going to be signed or not. Again, there were some hints that we were moving towards signing it. I can't see why people would think that. President Trump continues to insist that Iran must hand over its entire uranium stockpile to the United States. And the Iranians, for their part, are saying that is out of the question. It seems to me that in reality, the situation is deadlocked. And I again have to say that I think that those who think that the ongoing crisis in global energy situation is going to go away or be resolved very soon, I think they're being very unwisely and dangerously complacent. So that is one thing. But I do want to touch now on the situation in Cuba. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke about how a Russian tanker, the Andrei Kolesnikov, had arrived in Cuba and had unloaded something like 250,000 barrels of oil. The Russians tried to send another tanker to Cuba. There's some words that it has not been able to reach Cuba. Of course, most of the media attribute this to the American blockade. I am not so sure, if I have to say. And I have been reading the Cuban media carefully. And one of the odd things is that even as this ship has been steaming towards Cuba, the Cuban media has not mentioned it, which still suggests to me that there are factions within Cuba that are unwilling to receive oil supplies from Russia. This ship is said to be heading for Brazil, perhaps to refuel. Who knows why? Maybe this is all an elaborate dodge and it's going to go to Cuba after all. But anyway, let's put all of that to one side. There is a great deal of talk now about an American invasion of Cuba. To my mind, that would be a terrible thing. Whatever your feelings about the Cuban government, and I know that many people who watch these programs have very strong feelings, this would be a completely unprovoked aggression, another completely unprovoked aggression against a small sovereign country which has committed no aggressive act against the United States. The fact that back in 1996, two American aircraft were shot down by the Cuban Air Force, well, to my mind, that is not neither here nor there. And Secretary Rubio's attempt to build up some kind of great threat to the United States from Cuba's alleged possession of 300 drones is actually completely ridiculous. 300 drones against the United States of America, a nuclear power with powerful armed forces, a vast territory, a population in the hundreds of millions. I mean, it's nonsense. 300 drones is about as many drones as are used in any single attack in Ukraine now. The notion that Cuba poses a threat to the United States is completely ridiculous. It is absurd. So there are no grounds to invade Cuba. The fact that the United States doesn't like the government of Cuba, it never has done, going all the way back to the early 1960s, is not justification for invading Cuba. Certainly not at this time. Nonetheless, there is serious talk that that is what the United States might be planning to do. Now, Cuba is a small country of 11 million people. Small, but not tiny. We're not talking about a small Caribbean island state like, say, Grenada, which the United States military stormed in an operation back in the 1980s that I vividly remember. 11 million people is a sizable population, and it's also a country where Cuban men have been brought up to bear arms, where there is extensive national service and military training, and where many, many Cubans, as part of the militia system, actually own and retain weapons at home. Now, I mention all of this because that estimable American institution, one of the finest institutions in the United States, Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, is strongly advising the administration, the Trump administration, against a military attack on Cuba. They're saying that it is not going to be the walkover that some people in Washington imagine, that there could be intense fighting and that American soldiers might die and die in significant numbers. Well, that's what they're saying. I take their warnings seriously. Their warnings have been consistently right. I fear that, as too often happens, these warnings are not heeded. I am not going to speculate on what comes next, but to be frank, I dread the worst. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.